From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Just in case you're under the impression negative campaigning is a modern phenomenon, consider the race for president in 1800. It was John Adams up against Thomas Jefferson, and here's the actual language from that campaign. Adams supporters called Jefferson, in print mind you, the son of a half-breed Indian squaw raised on hoe cakes. Jefferson hired someone to write his attacks, a guy named John Callender, who called Adams a blind, bald, crippled, toothless man who secretly wants to start a war with France. So this stuff has been around for a long time, which begs the question, does it work? Today in the program, we're talking about negative campaigning. We'll talk about the tactics, how they work, why they work, when they go too far, and the effect all of this seems to be having on the American political process. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to categorize or properly measure negative political advertising, but there are a few metrics you can use. The Campaign Media Analysis Group did an accounting of the ads in the recent Florida Republican primary contest, and they pronounced it the most negative campaign on record. The group said 92% of the ads that aired in Florida were negative, and most of those ads came from the winner, Mitt Romney, or were produced by super PACs who support him. So whatever you think about negative ads, you could say they work. But do they always work anyway? And how do they work? Why do they work? Today in the program, we're talking about negative campaigning. We're exploring the history of these tactics and the impact they're having on the process. Do they coarsen the political conversation? Do they intensify divisions among voters? Do they suppress political participation or voter turnout? We invite you to join the conversation. What do you think about negative campaigns? How do you react to them, and what effect do you figure they're having on your vote? You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is David Mark. He's the author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. He's a senior editor at Politico. Before that, he was editor-in-chief for Campaigns and Elections magazine. And David Mark is joining us today from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena, California. David Mark, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with, the reputation of negative campaigning, because it's sort of considered to be questionable, of course, I guess for some obvious reasons and maybe not so obvious reasons. It's considered to have a kind of, you know, corrosive effect in some ways on the process and democracy, but you don't exactly see it that way. What do you make of, first of all, the reputation of negative campaigning, and how are you sort of seeing it these days?
I think we have to distinguish between negative campaigning and comparative advertising. Campaigns are a choice. They're essentially a binary choice. Only one of two candidates can win. In a primary, of course, you have a multi-candidate field, but something has to be done to distinguish between the candidates. And like in any job application, those seeking a job are going to emphasize some things and sort of gloss over others that maybe they're not so proud of. We've all done it in job applications. So I think it's really up to the opposition, to the media to a certain extent, but really the opposition running against them to kind of point out those flaws, those shortcomings, and let voters draw their own conclusions. I think that's where democracy works best, when voters have the greatest amount of information and can come to their own conclusions.
So do you figure that a lot of comparing, contrasting advertising is being labeled as negative? You know, things that aren't necessarily negative, that everything's being sort of put in that group.
Well, certainly, if you're looking at, say, this record of Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House in the late 1990s, I think that's entirely fair. Now, some of his votes or the issues he pushed or his legislative strategies, personal foibles, etc., may be taken out of context. It's probably not really what you might call a full picture, but that's really up to voters then to kind of do their own homework. It's certainly up to the candidate to respond to that and try to fill in the holes. And I think Gingrich, actually, of all people, has done a reasonably good job of trying to respond to that. And I think voters generally get these things right. Not always, but generally they can kind of see through what's a fair attack and what's false and misleading.
So what do we mean by negative campaigning?
Negative campaigning essentially means not playing up one's own attributes, what's good about yourself, what you would do in office to try and help your constituents, the people who are voting for you, but try and tear down the other side. And you alluded to this in the introduction. Often the real point of negative campaigning is to try and suppress turnout, get fewer people out to vote. Political professionals don't really like to discuss that publicly. They're not likely to write that in a campaign textbook. It's not the kind of thing you usually hear about in political science courses in college, but that's really the idea. It's essentially that you realized your own positive ratings can only go so high, so all you can really do is try and limit the amount of people who are going to come out and vote for the opposition.
But wait, what does that mean? Does that mean you get people so disgusted that they're not really interested anymore?
In a sense, yes. It's not really one of the prettier sides of our American electoral campaign system, but it's essentially saying, you know I have my foibles. We've looked at my approval ratings. They top out at maybe 42-43%. No matter what I do, nobody's going to vote for me beyond that. So what I've got to do is try and rip the other guy and make them such an unpalatable alternative that I'm essentially the last guy standing.
I wonder what you make of Florida. I just mentioned the analysis that it was the most negative ever. What do you think about that? And is there anything particularly unique, really, from your perspective about the Florida Republican primary?
I think there are a couple factors at play there. One is just the sheer magnitude, the volume of ads that have to be run to win statewide in Florida. It's not like the vaunted retail campaigning in Iowa, New Hampshire, even South Carolina to a certain degree. Florida has many media markets, probably over 10 or so, even a dozen. These are quite expensive in some areas, in Miami, in Tampa, in Jacksonville. You really have to have a lot of money. So that's about the only way you can communicate with people, and it's a lot easier to go negative in that sense. Also, we have to remember who was running these ads. In many cases, it was the so-called super PACs, not officially coordinated with the campaigns, but running kind of sort of affiliated with them by rich individuals. They have no constraints. They essentially have no shame in the ads they run. If you're a candidate, you want to be at least a bit careful about what you say about the opposition. You can get questioned about it by the media. If it's somebody on the outside with a group with which you ostensibly have no coordination, you can say, hey, I had nothing to do with that. I can't prevent what they do. And these groups have every incentive to be quite negative and do very little on the positive side.
Let's spend some time with the history of negative campaigning, which you've been writing about. It's hard to make direct comparisons, of course, to, like, say, the Florida Republican primary in the 1800 presidential election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, which got really ugly, I have to say. But can we just sort of broadly say that there's no such thing as the good old days? It's always been pretty ugly in American campaigning.
Absolutely. I would argue today's campaigns are actually at least somewhat more civil and genteel. The quotes that you read going into this hour were just an example of the kind of really vicious personal attacks on the candidates. It wasn't just on the candidates. It was often on their wives, even their children, and just some really tough stuff that we probably wouldn't hear about today. I remember the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, who we might say is not exactly physically svelte. He's not exactly an example of an Olympic caliber athlete. In other words, he's overweight. And that got brought up in 2009 when he was running for governor by his Democratic opponent, John Corzine, the sitting governor. There was a lot of backlash against that. You really can't get away with those kind of attacks. Also, at that point, the media was so fragmented, and it really was for the next century or so, where you could say one thing in a certain region of the country that you could not really get away with saying elsewhere. And this was something that, sadly, was often used in kind of racial attacks, really leading up to the early part of the 1920s, the early 20th century, where candidates would say one thing in the North, and they'd go down to the South, and they'd reveal these unvarnished racial attacks that you could never get away with today, thankfully. And I think it's actually for the better that we have these kind of nationalized campaigns where you can't say one thing in one state and something entirely different elsewhere.
It's interesting you also talk about an important distinction was in the early days of campaigning, people didn't campaign for themselves. They had other people, and so they could just pretty much say what they wanted to say.
That's right. When surrogates were out there campaigning on one's behalf, they were willing to go a lot further, just like the super PACs in Florida and elsewhere. If you're not responsible directly for your own words, you can let others say some pretty rough stuff that maybe you would not want to be associated with. And it was really well into the 19th century, even the early 20th century, before candidates regularly campaigned for themselves. Even in 1860, Abraham Lincoln essentially ran a front porch campaign while his Democratic opponent, Stephen Douglas, was out there on the trail. And that was one of the few times that we saw that for many decades. And so now that candidates have to be directly associated with their own words, I think that actually softens some of the rhetoric.
You write about the first, I guess, what was the first modern negative media campaign. This was 1934, the California governor's race. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that because it's really interesting. It's the novelist Upton Sinclair is running as a Democrat, and he's the first candidate, really, I guess, in sort of modern political American political history to be attacked for, what would you say, socialist inclinations.
Right. We have to remember this is during the depths of the Great Depression. Upton Sinclair had put out a plan, epic, as he called it, end poverty in California. The previous year, he wrote it as kind of a pamphlet-type book. This is sort of a utopian vision in which Californians would have a guaranteed wage, labor unions would be enhanced, and a lot of sort of left-leaning ideals, some of which came into being later on, some of which did not. And big business saw him as a threat all around. It was the movie studios who really came out and launched a full-scale negative campaign led by Louis G. Mayer at MGM. They put in newsreels in which they showed Soviet-sounding Bolsheviks with sort of not very sophisticated accents suggesting we want Sinclair to be elected. Others who look kind of like radicals on the docks in San Francisco that maybe mainstream Californians might not identify with. And it worked. This is one of the campaigns where I think we can say it directly led to defeat of a candidate. And this was at a time when newsreels were one of the main forms of communication. It's kind of hard to envision now, but if you think of those kind of baritone voice newsreels that you see in the old movies, that's how a lot of people got their information, particularly during the Depression, when going to the movies was one of the few forms of escapes from the kind of misery and drudgery of daily life.
So what were the lessons that people drew from that, I guess in some sense, this is effective. It works. It certainly worked in this case.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple lessons. One was the use of mass media. As I mentioned, newsreels, certainly radio was just growing into being at that point. And it just within the following few years, radio commercials for and against political candidates grew exponentially. Also, some of the themes that we would see a dozen to 15 years later, the sort of anti-communist sentiments that really took hold with Joe McCarthy in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and even a little bit before that against FDR in the 1944 presidential campaign, were kind of foreshadowed this kind of creeping sense, this growing sense of domestic threat that maybe you don't know what your neighbors are up to. And that's something that really got exploited in the following years.
I wanted to play an ad. This is one of the earliest political campaign ads during this television era, which you write about, which you say sort of negative campaigning really took off during the television era. 1964, and it's a pretty famous ad now. It was an ad for President Johnson, who was running against Barry Goldwater. Set this up for us, if you would, because I want to play this this sort of iconic political ad.
Sure. This is, of course, as you note, the infamous Daisy ad. Yeah. This is a commercial. It only ran once in September 1964 by the LBJ campaign. We can't quite call it a re-election campaign because right. He was the incumbent, of course, taking office upon the death of John F. Kennedy. And the theme behind it is that Barry Goldwater was an uncontrollable warmonger. He had made many statements suggesting that maybe some kind of tax projectile nuclear weapon ought to be lobbed into the men's room of the Kremlin, he said at this point. Barry Goldwater, of course, was a very prominent Republican senator from Arizona who had won the Republican nomination that year over a series of moderate rivals. This was really the beginning in modern times of the real hard right conservative movement. And it was really playing into the basis fears about what Goldwater would do as president of the United States.
So it's hard to play it on the radio, isn't it, David Marcus? It's really visual. Let's just sort of play this and just give us a sense of what people are seeing.
Sure.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's a girl picking up daisies,
7,
right? David
that's Mark? Right. Yeah. Innocent little girl looking as nice as can be.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
It seems almost comical now because it's so inartful, you know, and lacks, there's no subtlety in there whatsoever. But I guess it must have been pretty effective for its time.
That's right. It was what you might call a lack of nuance. This was as stark as you can get. And not just at that time, but I would say for the following decades, you still rarely hear this. It said that essentially if you vote for the opposition, people will die. This is what might be called the beginning of viral marketing, the kind of thing that we see on YouTube, Twitter, where all that needs to be done is played once and then gets picked up repeatedly. This was, of course, discussed on news programs, on television, radio, written about in countless newspaper columns at a time. That was the main form of communication. And the irony of this ad, of course, is that it was Lyndon Johnson as president who, within a year, was leading the country, the U.S., much deeper into war in a way that arguably maybe Barry Goldwater might not have done. We'll never know that. But I think this has really hurt LBJ's legacy in a way that his campaign certainly was never expecting at the time.
Let's talk about the 1968 campaign for president. There is an ad. We'll play a moment of it. It's another pretty visual ad. This is Spiro Agnew was, of course, the vice presidential nominee. And this is a kind of an attempt at humor, I guess, David Mark.
That's right. This is an ad where it's... There are very few words on it. We'll hear it in just a moment, but it's literally a stab at laughter and humor. It's, of course, taking issue at Spiro Agnew, who Richard Nixon had chosen to be his running mate on the 1968 presidential ticket. Spiro Agnew had only been elected governor of Maryland 2 years prior in 1966. He had little national profile. He was essentially chosen because he took a hard line with civil rights protesters during riots in Baltimore and elsewhere in the mid-1960s, and he was essentially kind of a no-name character chosen by Richard Nixon.
So what do we see in this ad? Because what you'll hear is pretty obvious.
We see, and I'm doing a little bit from memory, but I believe the wording on the screen is essentially Spiro Agnew for vice president with a question mark at the end. And that's about the only wording that we see as the soundtrack then comes on.
And there's a tag that says, this would be funny if it weren't so serious. Right. That seems incredibly nasty, David Mark, does it not?
Well, certainly it is, and it's to the point, and it's what we've heard in a lot of campaigns that – going after the vice presidential, the understudy, I don't think it usually works particularly effectively. Nixon himself was the target of one of the first negative ads back in 1956 in the Eisenhower reelection campaign in 1956 after Ike had suffered a heart attack. And there were suggestions and some concerns about Nixon potentially taking over as president. Of course, it was used against Agnew in 1968. Dan Quayle, 20 years later in 1988, all of those tickets won. So it's never been really, it's kind of funny to listen to, but it's never really been proven to be an effective tactic of negative campaigning.
David Mark is with us. He's a senior editor at Politico. His book is called Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about how negative campaign ads work and why they seem to work. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about negative political campaigning. Some are saying the Florida Republican primary was the most negative campaign ever, but whenever this subject comes up, you always hear that everyone says they hate negative ads, but everyone uses them because they work. And we're testing that idea today. Do they work? And how do they work? And why do they work if they do? 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Mark is with us, senior editor at Politico. He's written a book called Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. Also joining us now in the studio is Dave Owen. He's a Salt Lake City-based political consultant. He's written and produced scores of campaign and public policy advocacy ads for radio, television, and print, and around the country, not just here. And he's joining us in the studio. And Dave Owen, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me in. Nice to be back.
Let me ask you, we were talking with David Mark earlier about sort of broad impressions about negative campaigning. I guess the question I wanted to ask of you is, do they work? Do negative ads work?
Well, the answer to that is yes, they do. And I think we're far enough in that the evidence, it's obvious. Otherwise, people wouldn't be spending that money on them. There are some conditions and there are some places in the country where they don't work, which is kind of interesting, and some figures with which you have to be really careful. One of the key elements is it's helpful if it's basically true. My observation, although I don't really have a horse in the Republican nomination fight, my observation is that Newt Gingrich hasn't really been able to contest the facts of the ads. He's mostly, in my opinion, he's mostly complained about the fact of the ads,
yeah,
as opposed to what they're asserting, because most of it is at least true enough. So it helps if you can find enough material to make it true. The other thing is, and this is what we're seeing, you have to have enough money to drive it past effective into exhausting. And that's something that's never happened.
What does that mean?
Well, here in Utah, there have been little stabs at negative advertising, but nobody's ever really had the money to drive it all the way to the point where it would finally do what David was referring to, and that is, you know, we call it suppressing turnout, for example, or making the other candidate so unacceptable that people – we oftentimes try to get that last thought as the voter walks into the voting booth. Mm-hmm. What is he or she going to be thinking? And if that's negative about opponent B, then chances are they vote for candidate A. And so you have to have enough money to take it all the way. I think a mistake sometimes is made when people try to drive negative and they don't have enough money. The guy that kind of taught me this business always used to say if it didn't get 600 gross rating points, it didn't happen. And that's just a metric of television advertising. And I think it's true today, and it was true when I learned it long ago.
But do you think it's as true as it was? I mean, in an era of – I have to say it's interesting, David Mark, when you look at the 1964 Daisy Girl ad, that only ran once. But it got so many people talking about it that it sort of took on a life of its own. Isn't that part of the point, is not just the ad itself but the conversation that it creates?
Absolutely. It's the same reason why a lot of campaigns today create ads that only run maybe once or twice on local cable TV access at 3 a.m, where you can officially say that it ran on TV, but it's so kind of outrageous and outlandish that it then gets people talking. In a way, it's a great investment. You spend a minimal amount of money, and yet you get the full bang effect on it, and you get people really talking. And we see this race after race, and campaigns continue to do this because it's kind of like throwing a long ball. It's the only way, particularly if you don't have a lot of money, to kind of get people to notice what you're discussing.
So, Dave Owen, are you looking in some ways to get, and I'm thinking of the cable news cycles now, to get just if you can get it into the conversation there, then it will sort of take on a life of its own in that sense as well?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You're right. Leverage and earned media and getting into the echo chamber will replace dollars. I was just referring to the average, typical campaign that people do. And, obviously that one only had to run once.
Yeah.
And it's become iconic.
But I guess this shows the difference between a national campaign and a local campaign. Those differences are important.
Well, if I could just jump in here, I think we actually saw an example of this just yesterday on Sunday during the Super Bowl up in Michigan. Pete Hoekstra, he's a former congressman. He's now running for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate. He ran an ad on Michigan TV during the Super Bowl time on NBC, which was airing, of course, the game, taking issue with China, the trade practices, military issues with China, using some not very politically correct actors with accents. It certainly got a lot of attention. It's got a lot of criticism, but it sure has brought attention to his campaign. So it's that kind of idea of running something just once or twice and still bringing it to people's attention.
Dave, I wanted to ask you about, you referred to this just a moment ago. Sometimes there are places where negative ads don't work so well. Utah's one of those places, I guess.
Yeah, at least to this point, that's true. I can't remember, and David, maybe you do. There was a book written several years ago by a political scientist where he picked up – I even tried to go find this book, and I couldn't – where there were about 6 or 7 states in the country where there are reasons that you can't do negative advertising. I would say Mormon culture here in Utah makes it very, very difficult. People are extremely sensitive to it. I haven't seen it work. And in fact, I've seen it have the opposite effect. My understanding is that Vermont is one of those states. I can't remember the others. David, do you happen to remember?
Well, I haven't seen the book you're referencing. It sounds fascinating. Now I'd like to find it.
But yeah, me too.
One state I would note, which I have a chapter about, or at least a partial chapter in my own book, is the state of Delaware. Yeah. And that's for a couple reasons. One, it's just so darn small. It's actually the population. It's got close to 1 million people. But geographically, everybody's packed in. And when you're running for office, you probably know at least a good chunk of the constituents, the people you're trying to persuade. If you go after an opponent, they could very well be a friend or a family member of that person. So there's some real risk of backlash there. Another aspect, kind of unique issue in Delaware, is they do not have their own television stations. They only get television from Philadelphia and Baltimore. So if you run ads, you're actually probably wasting a lot of resources appealing to voters in Pennsylvania and Maryland that cannot vote in the campaign, the electorate you're trying to persuade.
But I guess to the point of whether or not this somehow injures the sensibilities of a culturally sensitive people like Mormons, I guess, Dave Owen, it can backfire. And I guess the question is, what can you not talk about? You know, where's your limit? Where's your boundary if you're thinking about all of that? Do you know?
Well, I think they're most effective. The ad hominem attacks would never go over here. You can't attack record. But I think we're looking at evidence right now. I mean, I'm not a paid advisor, but I'm helping a congressional candidate in Utah's 4th district who will be taking on Jim Matheson. Jim Matheson has returned to Congress 6 times.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that part of the reason for that
is— We should say, for those uninitiated, a Democrat.
A Democrat.
Yeah.
And I would argue that at least part of that reason is because of the outside groups that have come in and tried to do those really kind of snarky, derisive ads that are done in so many parts of the country and seem to work. I'd say, number one, they didn't have critical mass to be able to drive that message. Number two, we don't like that. We know Jim Matheson. You know,
we know his dad.
We know his dad. He's a revered late governor. Yeah. We ran into that in the 2010 cycle. I went back and did the the paid media for Sean Bilott versus Barney Frank. And in that, I'm sure in Massachusetts, negative advertising works just fine. The problem is Barney was a one-word name. You didn't refer to Congressman Frank or Barney Frank. It was just Bonnie. And he was – it's that old thing. He may be an SOB, but he's RSOB. And I felt like we had to really handle that carefully. And we could – and what we primarily did was soft negative that I've got to think that David Axelrod will be doing an ad just like this on our friend Mitt Romney, where we used Barney's words, comments, him on camera in an ad about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Let me play this. Actually, I think this is – let me make sure I get the right one here. Because I want you to talk about Dave Owen. And David, Mark, I want to hear your perspective too, because I think what you used here – was something that David Mark writes about as being important in the scheme of things, and that is a kind of a sense of humor, a sort of a lighter sensibility. Let me just play an excerpt from this, what you call, David, a soft negative ad for an opponent of Barney Frank.
While you were worried about keeping your job or paying your mortgage, Barney Frank was winging his way to the Virgin Islands on a private jet owned by a Wall Street fat cat who got $200 million in taxpayer bailouts. But Barney was on vacation. Barney wasn't worried about bailouts for Fannie and Freddie, which just doubled in cost, or bailouts for his billionaire buddies, or the $12 million TARP dollars he got for his friend's bank. He wasn't worried about the $500 billion he just cut from Medicare, or even the double-digit unemployment.
Okay, so you get the point there. This wasn't exactly the one we were referring to earlier. But you think this is soft negative, right?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely soft negative. It uses humor. I don't know too many ads I've had more fun making, and the television one was really funny. And you know, it did pretty well. We were obviously trying to exploit some things that had been in the news that people in Boston and the surrounding area in the 4th District had seen and were aware of and were maybe even a little bit ticked off at Barney about. And we were just trying to kind of put a little finer point on that.
David Mark, does that soften the impact in some ways of a negative ad if you give it a lighter tone?
Well, a couple things. I think Dave makes a really important point that negative campaigning, I think, often works most effectively when it kind of plays into preconceived notions that people already have about a candidate, and it kind of drives that point home. There had already been attacks on Barney Frank about the Fannie, Freddie mortgage bailout, his support of those institutions for years, and he's a pretty prominent, nationally known congressman. He's not your typical backbencher that most people have never heard of. So I think that was one effective tactic. And yes, on the point of humor, you really do need something to break through. And I think what people often find jarring about political ads is they look kind of different from what you see on television, where they're selling soap or a restaurant or some kind of dog food or whatever. Those are really polished. I know I'm from Southern California. I've seen a lot of those ads produced. They spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and days making 30-second ads. And as Dave Owen, I'm sure, can attest, in political campaigns, you're doing them on the fly, just sometimes in a couple of hours. Sometimes the production values don't seem quite as sharp, and I don't mean that specifically on this ad, but they're just different from what you usually see, and I think that makes them stand out in a lot of ways.
And sometimes you do that intentionally. Sometimes you have, especially if you're running the underdog, you don't want to look like the well-financed. The first three ads for Bilott we did in a single shoot, or at least we got the footage for them, and I shot them for $300 using a Brandeis film student and a handheld video camera.
I want to play the idea of whether which works better, a negative ad or a positive ad. Let me play an excerpt from another iconic presidential campaign ad. This was Ronald Reagan in 1984, the so-called Morning in America ad. Let me play a bit of that. And David, Mark, and David, I want you to talk about positive messages you send versus the negative messages we send. This is from 1984.
It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980, nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future.
So lots of soft light and happy smiling people, David, Mark. Did this ad work?
Well, that's the kind of ad you run when you're up by several percentage points,
right,
probably in the double digits. You don't really have to go negative.
Okay.
But I would just also note there, it's not a 100% positive ad. There are a couple references to the administration of 4 years previously.
Yeah.
Of course, there you had Walter Mondale, who was the vice president of Jimmy Carter. So it kind of gets in a few subtle digs at the opposition.
So wait, running a positive ad is kind of a luxury. You can really, in some ways, can only do it if you've got the margin there, I suppose.
It depends also on how well-known a candidate is. Often you're going to run positive ads earlier in the campaign, what are called intro ads, to give their kind of biography, let people know what they're about if they're not well-known, if they're not somebody who's been on the national stage for many years. And then as the campaign gets tougher, the rhetoric creeps up on both sides, then you kind of hit the other side. But really, why go negative if you don't have to? It can just make you look kind of mean-spirited.
Hmm. So, Dave Owen, how do you think about it? When we go negative, when we go positive, what's the equation you use?
Well, I think David makes a good point. It kind of depends on what the polling data is telling you. And in fact, good metrics are essential to understanding where you are. You can do contrast and define yourself, your candidate, and you can also define your opponent if the data supports your point of view. And we've had that a lot of times where we know we win on the issues, but for whatever reason, the candidate doesn't have that perception with the public yet. They either don't like them, they haven't embraced them, but you can win on the issues. We had an example, and I didn't have anything to do with it, but the last you'll remember in 2010, Mike Lee running for Senate here in Utah in a primary, which was really the race, against Tim Bridgewater. And I remember Mike Lee's ads were just about half and half. He hit his opponent on some things, said he believes this, he believes that, so forth. And then the second part of the ad was Mike Lee has a greater vision for America. I will say that for a lot of us, Ronald Reagan is iconic because it's that whole thing of there is hope. And you, at least in my experience, at some point you've got to build that in if you want some kind of a positive call to action.
Which is, I think, leads to the conversation about why negative ads work. David, Mark, why do they work? Because they appeal to our fears? Because they appeal to something maybe petty about us? Or do you even think about it like that?
I think most people, the average voter who's just trying to get through their life, raise their family, make a living, et cetera, are kind of distrustful of politicians to begin with. I say that about Democrats, Republicans, whoever they might be. So I think there's kind of a built-in willingness to frankly think the worst about those seeking elected office. So I think that's part of it. And people always like contrast. I think it's also just stands out again to what we see in the commercial marketing world, where you actually have a lot more restrictions on what you can say. If you're trying to sell laundry detergent, you've got to be real careful if you say our competition is really bad, because the Federal Trade Commission can come down on you, other local regulatory bodies. In politics, anything goes. So I think people are kind of drawn to the Wild West nature of it, if you will.
What do you think, Dave?
Well, I think David's right. I mean, again, one of my mentors, the late Chuck Sellier, who was not particularly a political guy, but he had decades in entertainment and marketing, used to say that if we were doing a commercial for a Ford pickup truck, we would have to have reams of data on every claim made in that ad. And you go into politics and you don't have to have anything. You can just make it up as you go. And we do see that sometimes. I was going to say that I've often told candidates, and I know this may irritate some listeners, but I usually say that people decide on they decide their vote with about as much energy as they do choosing between Coke and Pepsi. And that means that some people go into the store. I have clients in Atlanta. They don't ever choose Pepsi. They always choose Coke. And then there are other people that just happen to like Pepsi, and they do that all the time. And then the big majority, and here's where elections are decided, go into the store and see what's on sale. And, you know, I've been thinking lately, Doug, when did I do commentary for you guys? Back in the late 90s?
Yeah.
I think you could take a lot of those pieces and we could dub in a couple of words here and there and you could play because the issues are all the same. And I was watching one of the Shout shows and they were amazed at the fact that in Florida, I believe it was 26% of the voters said that they either made their decision the day of the primary or in the 3 days prior. Well, that's been true since the mid-90s. A quarter of the electorate makes its decision in the final 3 days. And that's why the cumulative effect of negative advertising is important, because it's that mindset when the voter walks into the booth, especially those late deciders.
Dave Owen is with us, Salt Lake City-based political consultant. David Mark with us, also senior editor at Politico. His book is called Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. So where is all of this headed? Is there something different about the 21st century political negative campaign? We will talk about that when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about negative political campaigning, how it works, why it works. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Mark is with us, senior editor at Politico. He's the author of the book Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. And political consultant Dave Owen is joining us here in the studio. Here's an email from Paul who writes, "My overwhelming impression when I hear a negative campaign ad is that they're somehow dishonest. Such ads are rarely anything but an attempt to poison the well or thrash the straw man. If an ad reflects good thinking and an honest critique of one's opponent, which Paul says is rare, he thinks, then I don't think of it as a negative ad." So, David Mark, how do voters think of ads that they see? Do they put them in these categories?
Again, I think they kind of are drawn to negative ads if it plays to some preconceived notion that right. they already had. I think with Newt Gingrich in this Republican primary race, that's really kind of been effective, the notion that he's kind of moved around a lot, that he's not been maybe he's had an imperfect personal life, we might say, that he's just not a really stable political figure compared to Mitt Romney. So I think that's really played into it. I think the attacks on, say, Mitt Romney have not worked particularly well because, yeah, we know he was a capitalist. He was in private equity. And sometimes these firms go buy and sell other businesses. It's not really surprising that he's rich once he released his tax forms. So I don't think there's been a lot of negative ads against Romney that have really brought up a lot of surprises. Whereas with some of the other candidates, I think it was much more effective.
Dave, you've said that negative ads don't test very well in focus groups, but they move the numbers.
Yeah.
Why?
I've never been in a focus group where anybody says they like an ad that's negative in that way. However, there are some interesting stories in my little memory bank here of, for example, doing a pure contrast ad between a Republican and a Democratic congressional candidate. And when we took it to focus group, we intentionally put three lean Democrats in the focus group. And we had some Republican leaners and then some neutrals. And it reinforced on the two extremes exactly why they were voting for their particular candidate, which is exactly what we wanted because we knew we won in the district on the numbers. And toward the end of the discussion, one of the lean Democrat ladies said, "Well, that's not a very good picture." And we actually on that one went back and recut, put a nicer picture in, and the ad was very effective. People have gotten away from that at this point. I've often – sometimes, David, I look at some of these ads that they've done on Newt Gingrich, where there's an embarrassment of riches in things to do negative ads about. And I wonder if they really need to be as derisive and snarky, or if they could be – go back to that guy. I was going to say that Reagan ad sounded like it was by the Ketchup Advisory Board on Prairie Home Companion. But if you went back to that kind of soothing older gentleman's voice and just stated the facts about Newt Gingrich, I wonder if people would feel differently.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think also you bring up the visuals. And with Newt Gingrich, there's a lot of sort of old pictures with him with a kind of 5 o'clock shadow. Yeah. His hair was unkempt. His personal image seems to have improved as he's got returned to the national scale. But it may be a little bit of overkill there. And it actually may be inoculating him a little bit in that people already know some of these things about him and they're not really holding it against him at this point.
So I guess the question is, what is different now? And one of the obvious factors you've got to take into account here, David Mark, is the Citizens United ruling from the Supreme Court, the emergence of super PACs. How are they changing the way this is playing out?
Well, as we were discussing earlier, super PACs have little incentive to stay positive. By their very nature, they essentially exist to come in and tear down the opposition. If you can get a $5 million check or whatever it might be from one source, and if you're not directly associated with a candidate, why would you stay positive? Why not go for the jugular and really try and tear down the opposition? So I think we're going to continue to see the rise of super PACs and their kind of negative their approach to negative campaigning that I think is going to kind of overshadow the real campaigns. A lot of this work also used to be done by the party committees, the Republican National Committee, the Democratic National Committee. They've kind of gotten sidelined. One other trend I think we're going to see, it's a kind of micro-targeting individualization of political ads. Just when you pull up a website and it might show an airline that you've flown recently or a food that you bought, I think they're now going to track our individual web presence and really try and promote candidates or tear down other candidates through our own personal web data that they've gotten off of Facebook or other ways on the internet.
Dave, is this changing the game? I mean, the sense that with shifting media landscape, conventional political ads, I mean, you've got to be thinking differently and more creatively, I suppose, the way people are looking at media, I suppose.
Absolutely. And also there's just a universality to media now. I mean, what is the media? When you exactly what David's talking about. But even on television, look at all the different outlets. Look at cable. Look at how you can segment the audience. I have public policy clients who know that if you want to affect a state legislature and you want to get to the Democratic vote, you run your ads on CNN and MSNBC. If you want to get to the Republican side, you run your ads on Fox News. And if you have a call to action in there, the right folks will get the message from the viewers. It's just sliced down so many different ways. The trick used to be nice on TV and then just absolutely savage in the mail. And that's becoming not less true. It's becoming more true, except people aren't nice on TV anymore either.
Here's an email from Catherine. She writes from Wanship. I recently heard that TV political ads are not as effective as in the past for the following reasons. The economic crisis has caused a great many to cancel their cable TV service. People don't want interruptions in their TV viewing, so they don't watch the shows with a lot of ads. People are getting their news from their biased internet news sites. David, Mark, what do you think about that? I mean, it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier. We go to these places that confirm our beliefs. A political ad works in that way as well, I suppose.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to what the emailer person is saying, that people are watching less TV, whether it's for economic reasons or just shorter attention spans that people have now. I see people, I admit I do this myself, watching TV. I'm sometimes looking at my iPhone at the same time. I'm seeing what else is going on in the world. And you just kind of tune that out. Also, people have TiVo and they go right past those commercials, which really drives ad makers crazy because it kind of eliminates the reason for being in a lot of ways. So I think TV commercials are going to have to find ways to get more strategic about it and really kind of break through the clutter. And that's a lot easier said than done.
David Mark, what is the impact of a negative ad overall? I mean, you hear people say that it it coarsens the dialogue. You've heard those kinds of things. But you tend to be say that there are good things to this, that it gives people information. It kind of empowers voters to find out more.
Just knowing political candidates of all stripes, they're going to want to emphasize certain aspects about their resume, their experience, what they've done in life, and they want to kind of gloss over others. So I think it's actually kind of helpful. In fact, more than kind of, it is helpful to have somebody else kind of coming in and saying, you know what, there's another side to the story here, and then let voters make their own conclusions. I would not recommend voters make any decision based on one television commercial or watching Fox or MSNBC by themselves, but by drawing in a broad range of information and then making their own decision. And that's really up to individuals. It's being a part of a good member of the democratic society. It doesn't often happen that way, but I think that is what can be positive about being negative.
One thing, Dave Owen, you've pointed out is sort of the practical effect of negative campaigning, and it can have a negative effect on some campaigns. You've mentioned to us that Mitt Romney's negatives have gone up as a result of some of this.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's always been a conundrum for candidates whose negatives are hovering around the high 40s is that when you go negative, you drive your opponent's negative rating, but you also drive your own. And that's going to be, I'll tell you what we're going to see in the fall. And I'm actually more dispirited about it than David is. I think it really does. We sit around, we look, and we wring our hands about the fact that this country is becoming more and more ungovernable. And while I wouldn't suggest we infringe the right of providing negative advertising, nor would I turn down the business. the fact is we have to recognize the cost. And I truly believe that this fall we will elect as president the second most hated man in America. What's the impact of that for the next 4 years? You can already see it in Congress. It's already there now, and it's going to get worse.
David Mark, let me give you a final word. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, and I think that's a fair point. I don't mean to suggest that everything is fine and dandy with negative ads and that they only serve a positive purpose. I think the trick with the country becoming kind of ungovernable is to have our leaders some way after the election saying, you know what, of course our goal is to defeat the opposition the next election, but we're, at least for these next 18 months or so, we're going to try and come together and come to whatever solutions we can. That may be Pollyannish, naive, but I think voters would probably gravitate more toward that and leave the campaigning maybe toward the final 6 months of the campaign, if that's at all possible. And I it probably is not, I fully admit.
It's David Mark. He's the author of the book Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. He joined us from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena, California. David Mark, thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And Dave Owen, good to see you again. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.